substance equals spurn. The propaganda's a win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1 of 200, the Independent Media and Politics Podcast. We're here for another midweek podcast covering some issues. I'm joined by my co-host, Mark Rickaby. How are you doing, Mark?
Kia ora koutou. I'm doing. I'm okay.
Great. And we're joined from over in the United States, David Ferrier. How are you doing, David?
Kia ora. I'm good. I'm going to give a more positive answer. I'm great. Loving life. Nothing to be worried about. Life is good.
Are you thriving?
I'm thriving. What else does one do in Los Angeles but thrive?
Triple, maybe. Panic?
Yeah, it's true enough. Panic. No, it's a very unusual place. I made the mistake of installing this app called Citizen on my phone, which alerts you to sort of geographically based crime around you. So I hear about, you know, someone with an axe two streets over, or someone naked 50 meters away, and it keeps me on my toes, keeps me paranoid.
That sounds fantastic.
I wish we had a fear machine on my phone, yeah. A fear machine sitting there alerting me to all the things I can be afraid of today.
Specific things, not just generic.
Deeply specific, comically specific. And some of them are useful. You know, the fire, you know, at the CVS, that's good to know. You know, I won't go there to get my toothpaste today, but some of the more domestic stuff, I don't think anyone needs to know. But it sort of makes you feel like you're just surrounded by an insane amount of crime, which is a wonderful feeling to carry around with you during the day.
In New Zealand, a lot of people feel like that regardless.
Yeah, it's the crime hype, right?
Yeah, I hope we never get that app.
I don't recommend it, and I will be uninstalling it. It was sort of a social experiment on my own brain to see how I'd feel about the world after a month of using it.
Well, I guess that kind of segues into what we want to talk about, which is, I guess, content generation more broadly, and the different technological advents of that in the media industry. This episode kind of came about off the back of a tweet that you made regarding an Adweek story. And it was about Google paying small publishers to use its AI to just create stories. Predominantly, we imagine scraping from larger media organizations and news organizations, and they're paying these smaller independent companies the astonishing five figures to start using their service. It doesn't bode well for the state of the media industry when one of the largest technology companies with overwhelming reach and power is, or seems to be, actively trying to undermine it with just a bizarre scattershot strategy.
Yeah, I thought approaching the smaller publications was an interesting move. And it is funny that we're just talking like, you know, a few thousand dollars to do it. That's not big money. But yeah, it's, I think Adweek said in that piece that made it clear the publishers don't have to say that they're producing AI generated work, you know. And, you know, talking to some colleagues who are working in tabloids over in the UK, you know, they're jumping into this AI-generated content pretty quickly and, you know, just chucking any old name on there. So I think this idea, there's two things going on, really. It's, yeah, the AI-generated content and then just not even attributing or letting a reader know that it's AI-generated, or just providing a name that people assume is a human, but it's just a made-up, you know, made-up name. It's pretty alarming. I think the internet at the moment, pre-AI, was full of filth, but it's just going to get messier.
And this, I guess, was somewhat predictable in the, inverted commas, content space. We've seen it happening in art over the last couple of years. Lots of AI art being created using very specific terms that clearly mean that copyrighted material is being scraped to create these, I don't know what to call them, pieces of media. I don't want to call them artwork. And yeah, now it seems to be heading written work as well. We'd seen a lot of that being hyped up through ChatGPT and other similarly boosted, inverted commas again, AI platforms. Is this something, yeah, you said you're already hearing about people using it in kind of tabloid media. Is this something that you think will stick in a way that I'd argue it, you know, it's had a really negative reception in the art world and in the games industry. But does tabloid kind of get away with it?
I think tabloid journalism probably does, because they already get away with so much. I mean, I wish I had a clear answer on this, and I don't. I think what I find worrisome is that audiences increasingly don't seem to be particularly good at checking sources. They just want things that sort of seem shocking or interesting or are relevant to their own lives and their own sort of fears and worries, and they react accordingly and click it or read it. And I don't think it'll make much difference if, you know, those pieces are not written by a person. And I think it's bad. In my mind, there'll just be more incorrect information available to people sort of dressed up as journalism, and people will swallow it without really thinking. And I think that is a major problem, because, you know, as we've all seen, you know, AI can scrape it and can spit out an article, but there will certainly be mistakes in there as well. So even if it's semi in the right direction, the AI is going to make sure there's still plenty of errors in there. So look, I think overall audiences have proven that they are not particularly great at sort of passing information. And I think this will just mean there's a lot more terrible information around for them to feed into their brains and probably just accept. I mean, people read a headline or a paragraph and accept it and sort of move on. Like, people don't even read the whole thing anymore. So it's just going to be more horrific headlines, people reacting, taking that little sentence and that informing their view of the world, and they'll move on to the next thing.
Mark, you've been across this and some of those other industries. Is this something that you kind of saw the line stretching out in front of you back when some of the stuff got launched?
It's difficult to sort of sum it up overall in kind of one story, I think, because I actually had quite an optimistic viewpoint at one stage about about AI and journalism. I remember several years ago, I can't remember the exact time, I actually had a chat to some people at Stuff around AI. I heard that they were doing a project with some automated text, and I was really curious because I've been developing software and systems in that space. And I was like, hey, can we have a chat about maybe looking at some of the stuff I'm doing? They're like, oh, no, we've got this big company and they're going to sort it all out for us. But at that stage, and actually I should sort of bookend that by saying that that project never surfaced and it didn't really work out. I guess my optimism came from this idea that there was a lot of journalism that wasn't happening. I can actually date this because I think it was before the Public Interest Journalism Fund sometime, which did potentially make, it's hard to say the difference that it made. That's probably another tangent that I won't go down on.
Yeah, it's a good tangent to go on.
Yeah, what were the KPIs of that for the media organizations? And maybe we can come back to that one, actually, because I think it is related in some ways. But what I thought was that a lot of the local publishing, a lot of the, you know, the sports news, being able to open up a local, very, very regional, very specific paper, or go online to a website and see the games, that your cricket games that your kids were in, and see little write-ups of all the stuff happening around communities. And I saw the potential for generated text to be used in journalism to kind of expand the range of possibilities for what a newsroom could cover. That probably sounds a bit silly now, given what we've seen over the last sort of 4 to 5 years. But I it was cool to hear that people in newsrooms in Aotearoa here were actually thinking about that and exploring it. It's not the future that we've seen, unfortunately. Things did go in a different direction. And going back to your original question, Kyle, I do think that, yeah, we always have had this potential, and it always has been kind of visible that as soon as the bar to entry was low enough with machine learning and generated text, it would be utilized by all kinds of people with all kinds of agendas. And a big part of that would be what we used to call spam. And I think spam now has evolved into more information warfare. Disinformation, misinformation, also just kind of accidental, just lack of fact checking, like the stuff that David was just talking about, going out, where It's just, I think there's a strong relationship to the way that people are consuming the content and the what they want out of it. And so I actually agree with David that whether something's AI generated or not isn't actually that impactful at the moment of reading it. It's about the dynamic of how people are consuming news. And I think that's the thing that's having the impact. And what AI is doing is just reducing the cost of generating spam. It hasn't changed anything. It hasn't sort of like fundamentally reoriented the sort of misinformation capabilities that are already out there, or invented this new way. You know, there's no new information being shared. It's all based on existing language that's sort of been filtered. But what it is doing is just radically reducing the cost and the speed of being able to just put out the slop.
I think spam is such a great way of thinking about it because it is just spam. It's just the same old ideas, bad ideas, some good ideas potentially, mostly bad ideas is recycled and shoved down everyone's throats. I think spam's a great kind of take on that.
And that's really an indictment of where the media industry has found itself in some regards. Like, if you can imagine a healthy media industry where the profit margins aren't the most important thing, introducing generative text could be used, like you were saying, Mark, to make useful information that people want to read about their communities. It's that the information space is already so filthy that adding this in just creates a replication loop. People are getting what they want to see, but what they want to see has already been fed by a system trying to condition them to want to see a particular thing for the last 100 years, if we want to like go back a fair amount, and obviously with acceleration over the last few decades. Is this then just a question, I say just, but significantly a question of the purpose of the media industry or media corporations within the current system, more so than it is about the types of technologies that we're using?
I think a good way of looking at that is looking at the situation that's happening in Australia right now, where you basically have the sort of cartel of large news organizations going up against Facebook directly. Google's also had lots of run-ins with them. And you know, the way that it's being framed in Australian media is the sort of bad tech companies versus the sort of small bean newsrooms. But what's really happened, you know, which they're not sort of confronting directly, is that the ad revenue has been undermined. Now that's not coming from AI or generative text. That's a long wave. You know, that goes back to the early 2000s. And these media companies did not invest in technology. They chose not to. They chose to try to maintain existing business models. And Facebook and Google came along, and they caught up to that shift too late. Now, I'm definitely not defending Facebook and Google, and I think that we've seen a range of anti-competitive tactics and monopolism and all sorts of very forceful behaviors from those companies. But I think it's a really good kind of lens on the sort of, I guess, the refusal to sort of face like kind of this sort of self-awareness or kind of critique of one's own sort of position that's the framing coming. It's not just from Murdoch and News Limited. It's Nine News and the others as well. They're all, they're like, oh, we're going to get these tech companies. We're going to make them sign this. And we're going to make the government make this new legislation that's going to make them pay us for the news that they're stealing off us. And it's like, that's great, but like that's not actually addressing the revenue issue, which is the dependency of all these news orgs on ad revenue. When that fell through the floor, you know, I think this might be an oversimplification, but we are kind of at the end of the long tail of all of that period. And I think the AI stuff is just kind of there now filling that space, you know, and that kind of the wreckage is sort of already there, I guess.
It's very much feels like the case. And you know, we were just talking before the podcast about here in New Zealand, one of the major television newsrooms announced that it was going to be shutting down mid-year. That's News Hub. And there's now news out about an hour ago when we're recording this, that there's going to be some announcements about TVNZ, which seem to, at the very least, be signalling redundancies among staff there. You were mentioning, I think it was just, you, David, just before, about trying to drive the cost down, essentially. It makes it a lot cheaper for the tabloid companies to be publishing what they publish if they don't have to be employing a lot of people to do so. A lot of this just feels incredibly anti-worker, first and foremost. How is there even any way for newsrooms or media organizations that were set up under that framework to shift gears on this, given that, you know, they have shareholders, they have a bottom line, they have KPIs from the government around how they get their funding, or if there are political decisions made about whether that funding is going to go through at all. That amount of funding has been dwindling alongside ad revenue as well. And the constant call is that you need to cut costs in that case. And look here, there's a very useful way to do that all of a sudden.
Yeah, the traditional newsroom, and certainly, I mean, TV newsrooms are so incredibly expensive to run, and I don't see how long-term they can, you know, it's a few things happening at once, right? And certainly the way people consume their information has changed dramatically. And also, I think the eroding of trust in journalism has happened and accelerated so quickly, especially post, I think during and post COVID, that has sort of really sped up. You know, I first noticed that. And I feel like 2016 onwards, kind of like the second, you know, the first Trump presidency. Hopefully we don't get a second one. We probably will. There's been this erosion of trust, and so that's also an issue, plus people are just consuming all their media differently. You know, I've had friends losing jobs in the last couple of weeks from, you know, from Vice. I've got friends of the LA Times that have been let go, that have been there forever. I've got, you know, so many friends at News Hub that will be out of work. And yeah, all these big newsrooms are expensive places to run, and if people aren't reading that content and advertisers aren't willing to pay the megabucks and people aren't even trusting that content in the first place, it seems like it is an inevitable sliding away of that. And yeah, the only way to try and produce anything is to make it cheaper. And again, yeah, as you said, that's when AI comes in. It all feels, I mean, I've been feeling incredibly bleak about it all the last couple of weeks in particular, since the News Hub news, because I don't really... You know, and then we see these, you know, New Zealand is such a strange place to be observing, and I'm terrible at predicting things, and I don't have a wide enough knowledge to kind of be able to make big calls on things. But just seeing some of these smaller sort of right-leaning outlets, like, you know, the Sean Plunkett's, you know, sort of privately funded platform called The Platform. I mean, that's an example of how something will work, right? Like, organizations will work if they have, like, a big backer that's willing to invest and they are aligned politically in a certain way and they want to pump that money in. And if there's an audience for it, you'll just get these pockets of information and these little tiny outlets. The kind of, you know, places being targeted by Google to plant their AI news in, you know, just these like small little spots. It's just fracturing. And I don't know what that means long term, but it's... In New Zealand, it seems it's getting pretty bad. You know, even looking at something like, I don't know what it's called, that conspiracy radio station they have. Reality Check, which grew out of a conspiracy movement, you know, that we saw over COVID. You know, that stuff is, it's not huge, but it's slowly growing. And when you see an entire TV news network going down and all you see, as far as comments on Facebook or Twitter, is, you know, yay, the woke media is going down, and you have, you know, Winston Peters calling the media woke. It just seems like, as far as like, you know, journalism is being, it's being attacked in a pretty horrific way. And I always feel like I'm sort of, you get a bit preachy. I get sick of hearing journalists, you know, they're so earnest. I think we all are, and I kind of hate myself when I start hearing myself getting earnest, but it's just such a downer when people just don't grasp the concept of what journalism is and what it's meant to be doing, and that's just so lost now.
The distinction I've been making over the last couple of weeks is the difference between media and journalism. You know, you're talking about the platform and Reality Check, and these companies don't need to compete for advertising revenue or any kind of funding. I obviously don't have financials for these companies, but I cannot imagine that they are making a profit currently. There is a reason they needed millions of dollars backing to kick them off. But even when people are talking about the woke media or whatever, you know, and my contention, I guess, is that a lot of that isn't good faith engagement. It's not genuine. No. A lot of it is driven by the same people who are pushing for these small far-right platforms to be stood up. It's not the media that they are against. No. It is reportage. It is news. It is journalism. It is people holding people to account and holding power to account in particular that they tend to be targeting. And, you know, as we've said, like, the platform is pretty small currently, but, or reality check is, we've had government ministers go on both of those. I don't know if you saw the news today, but David Seymour was on with Sean Plunkett this morning, and Sean Plunkett called for a pogrom of people who criticize the government. And this is a guy who's going to be deputy prime minister in 12 months. And he was able to, like, palm it off. But it's not, these organizations are not on the outside as much anymore.
No, they're not. I mean, I got incredibly frustrated when I saw Mark Jennings pop on Reality Check Radio. I'm like, you know, I'm like, you're better than this. Like, you don't need to jump on this.
Spoilers, he's not better than this.
Yes.
He showed up.
Yeah,
to
it's
it.
My,
yeah.
You know, I'm talking favorably about my old boss at News Hub, you know, who I had like some affectionate feelings for at times. But yeah, it's giving legitimacy to these places is just so incredibly frustrating to watch. You know, I used to get annoyed, and, you know, I have a long-running sort of annoyance with Sean Plunkett, so I don't want to turn this into a personal sort of rant against him. But,
very
you know, I'd get frustrated when people would engage with Sean on Twitter, just average, everyday people engaging with him. You know, don't engage. You make him look bigger than he is if you're actively commenting. He's baiting you like a complete, that's all he's doing. And then it's just this added level now where, oh my God, he's baiting politicians and you know, news bosses like Jennings. And it's like, why are you doing this? Like, why are you jumping? Anyway, that's just a whole other, it's frustrating to watch it happen.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to how much the media industry is about perceptions, right? And about where the audiences are. And I think something I've heard, I think it was Chris Hipkins saying, is you have to go with we might be able to reach people, right? And I'm okay with that reasoning. I don't think the people are there in particular, and certainly not necessarily many you're going to reach. Plunkett's probably past that point now, though, where he is a significant block of audience. And you've seen organizations like News Talk ZB trying to tap into that now as well. You know, they'll be running stories that got sourced in the platform and things like that, and spiraling their own stuff off that. And it's really feeling like we are no longer talking about a media industry, but a communications industry where these smaller, presumably, ostensibly independent outlets, often on the right wing or the far right, almost certainly backed by very rich, very wealthy people, are being used as a communications platform to push a particular ideology or a particular set of feelings. And because they can run at a loss, a significant loss, they're able to do that at pace in a way that journalism or news outlets cannot keep up with. And I guess one of my worries is, and it would be interesting to hear what both of you think about this, is that AI makes that a problem exponentially. Like, it's going to cause so much more issues in that space when, if you're just running a comms line, like, you're just running PR, that doesn't need anything. And you've already got a framework from which to move it from the platform, to move it to News Talk ZB, to move it to the Herald or to Stuff. We've seen that play out a couple of times already with some major political stories. What is this? What do you think of that, and how do we do anything about it?
Well, it's such an easy question to answer.
Oh, you know, we love those here. Please,
I don't even know where to begin. I'm stunned.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about running at a loss thing is quite interesting, because it made me think that, well, like, for starters, that's not unprecedented. You know, going back to the Australia example, News Limited has been running the Australian as a broadsheet, running at a loss of about $20 million a year for decades. You know, they just absorb that. And the Australian is it's fairly mainstream. It has its ideological positions. It has some horrific columnists on the sort of on the similar level to Sean Plunkett, you know, people like Andrew Bolt. But it's also all the sports news and all the kind of it's been a place where, like, literature and books have been reviewed, you know, as that stuff has disappeared from all the other Australian media, kind of similar to what's happened in New Zealand. But they're absorbing that loss. And I think that that sort of says something interesting about the kind of perception of, like, what's important and what's valuable. And being able to do that is a consequence of that vertical integration and having that kind of company sort of controlling a lot of those different aspects. So I wonder how much of these problems in newsrooms are actually, I'm not going to say unrelated to the changes in audience and the like internet dynamics, because I think that stuff's really important. But I think financialization is sort of the root of a lot of the issues in New Zealand particularly. And I think that that's where I think Kyle sort of decoupling the idea of journalism and the work of journalists from media, I think, is really important insight for people to get their heads around, because I think that really helps actually position, like, the what's going on at the different layers, and that journalism can be expensive, you know, and getting stuff closer to facts and the truth and checking in with sources and verifying things, that takes time and it costs money, and that but it's also really important, because that's how we get meaning, that's how we get, like, a shared understanding of what's going on and our communities and what's going on in politics around us. So, you know, the function of how newsrooms do that, that's been the standard for a long time. You know, maybe there are innovations and ways that that can change. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a journalist, and I don't have the sort of expertise in how that working environment could evolve. But I think for me, the important thing is more just that people at decision-making or executive levels are willing to commit to that process. And I think with the financialization, that commitment is kind of at arm's length, because things are being controlled by hedge funds and decisions go up the chain and it's just based on balance sheets. And so I just don't think it's possible to get the public outcomes and the kind of reporting outcomes that people want from a system that's based in financialization. And that's where I think, you know, it ties back into what we're seeing in the entertainment industry and in the games industry with the mass layoffs. It's all the same dynamic, I think.
Yeah, completely. And I think, yeah, it's the film industry over here, I mean, everything is, I mean, it's post-strike as well, and everyone's kind of scrambling and trying to recover. But documentary and filmmaking in general, it is in a pretty tricky spot as well. And of course, AI affects that. It's funny with News Hub, you know, I think when Discovery came in, you know, we'd always been, you know, shoved between all these different owners and banks, etc. But there was this idea that, you know, Discovery was going to come in, and they did chuck a bunch of money in, you know, early on, and they were going to be like sort of the saviors of it all. But they were the ones, obviously, that were just like, no, we're losing too much. We're completely bailing on all this. But the whole, you know, TV3 in general now, it's just going to be a whole other different beast, you know, without those news programs, you know, sort of ruling the night and getting eyeballs on the TV. You know, I think viewership's going to drop dramatically. And then, of course, New Zealand On Air isn't going to be wanting to, I assume, you know, fund projects for that station. And it's just going to end up being, you know, remember when C4, the music channel, sort of stopped having presenters and it just ended up, you know, it was just constant reality shows. I mean, that's going to, I assume, be three now. So it's got this trickle-on effect where, you know, yeah, news is what holds a station together. And it's not like we're just losing news on three. We're going to lose all the original programming, which employ so many really talented, wonderful New Zealanders. All that'll disappear and it'll just be reruns of Married at First Sight and whatever other reality shows are knocking about. And those shows are fine. There's a place for them. But it's we're going to lose a lot from this. And it's fascinating that Discovery was the one to actually finally pull the plug.
I often wonder whether or not it's a uniquely New Zealand issue as well. And I really hate New Zealand exceptionalism, but given how narrow our audience is, and it feels like how little the TV networks here have been, what's the right set of phrases, pushed to or supported to go big overseas, except for some really notable examples. You know, we're an industry that people come to get a tax cut on, right? Like, we're not an export industry for this stuff. And that, alongside our really small population and the financialization that you're talking about, Mark, that means even TVNZ, which is the publicly funded broadcaster, is expected to at least be breaking even, at least be trying to like find money somewhere. It's kind of become an inevitability that things are going to start falling over once we get parts of civil society or people in power or people with money who want to aggressively attack the information space. Yeah, it feels sometimes like the solutions were 20 years ago. And the solutions now are to do what the people in the platform are doing or with Reality Check Radio. And that is find a benefactor who really, really cares about news and just have them do it. I'm similar to you, David. I'm so gutted about the loss of institutional skill and knowledge that we're facing with the collapse of the newsroom. It employs so many people who have such specific sets of skills for communicating to people. It's a real worry to me as well. What do you do in the political climate, let alone in the news climate, when there is one broadcast TV channel trying to keep up with everything that's happening? You know, they can't keep up now. Like, they plus everyone doing YouTube and doing podcasts is unable to keep up with the current pace of not just political change, but environmental change, of global change. And then let alone, again, tie that back to the communities that are meant to be their audiences. I mean, in my opinion, we should just be giving billions just to like try and sort this stuff out.
I think there's this overall idea that, you know, as individuals with our, you know, internet presences and being connected over social media like never before to a variety, to everyone and everything, I think there's this idea that, I mean, the idea of journalism has sort of almost been entirely lost. And as long as you can jump on the internet and like read some stuff yourself, you're getting the firsthand research. You know, it's almost just that idea of do your own research, like writ large. That's just, I think, the way so many people think about things now. And I think you could talk to so many Kiwis and so many Americans or people in the UK that just have a blanket distrust for, they just see journalism and think, oh, those are, I don't know what people think, just brainworms about whatever the word journalism represents. And they think, no, I can jump online and just find stuff out myself. I can do it myself. I can see it myself. And that's the information I'm going to roll with. And I think when you've got a lot of population thinking in that way, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how you recover from that. Like, it feels really depressing to me.
And it also means that the technological kind of tools that they're looking to fill some of that gap with, they become less effective as well. Because if you have no newsrooms, where are they going to be scraping the news from? You know, I was having this conversation a week or so ago with someone. Like, our podcast can't exist without other people going and doing the news professionally. You know, I'm not...
Yeah, you're breaking things down. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not reporting the news. I'm analyzing and critiquing it. We're doing a cutaway. We are not out there collating news out on the ground, getting witnesses or people involved in events and getting firsthand accounts. We're not doing, or very rarely, we're doing empirical evidence gathering. We and everyone else, you know, these people with like 2 million YouTube subscribers who do news kind of media, and make a lot of money doing it. They don't do news, and they cannot exist in an environment where newsrooms don't exist. And I'm not sure, well, I don't know, cynically I am sure that people with a lot of power in the media industry understand this, and they don't care. But I'm not sure a variety of other people have really grasped how quickly that pipeline collapses from this point onwards.
Yeah, I think the real question is, what do the people at the top of the tech industry think about that? Because they're the people who are actually shaping a lot of what's going on, you know? And I think that that's interesting to me, because I've worked in tech companies and I've seen the behavior of tech executives towards the media, you know, and this conspiratorial bent, it's been there for a lot longer than people realize, because people in tech were conditioned to see the press as a source of public relations for them, a sort of marketing outreach. And when critical stories started getting written, they started losing their minds. And this is not just a US thing. I have seen it in Australia as well. Like, how dare they do journalism? How dare they ask questions about our intentions? That's not their job. Their job is to help us get new customers.
We looked at all of Elon Musk's early press, right? It was all just I've never seen so much praise for years before anyone dared not even be that critical, but just to start asking a few questions.
Yeah, sure. And that was a dynamic with a particular subset of reporters. You know, you can't make a blanket judgment about the entire news industry based on that dynamic amongst a small group of people. But that had a really massive influence. And I think that the issue now is more like there's been a sort of an increasing radicalization amongst these tech executives towards. So I think a lot of the stuff that that we've been talking about today, I actually think a lot of these people with significant power in the tech industry do realize this, but they think it's actually a good outcome for them. They understand what's happening with newsrooms. They get the dynamics that we've been talking about, but it's not a negative outcome for them. It's actually a positive outcome.
And then that goes on to also being the opinion of people they give campaign funds to, right?
Yeah, well, it's sort of rent a politician. We can go on and on about how far that actually goes. I think it was some pretty funny stuff a while back here in New Zealand about the cost of a bullet point in New Zealand First's policy document, which was estimated to be around 50k, which seems pretty low, to be honest. And you know, there's that was it a tweet or a blog post a few years ago about how US politicians should wear NASCAR jackets with all their corporate sponsors on. It's more the I think the tech executives have this decision capacity that's reaching beyond politics, because they have this direct influence financially. And you can see that is starting to kind of manifest in a lot of different ways. If I was a news executive right now, I would be ring fencing and guarding and protecting as much as I could, and trying to create a real separation between those kind of lines. I certainly wouldn't be reaching out for partnerships with companies like Google, you know, unless they are very, very explicit and clear about their intentions and the kind of exchange. And I think, you know, people were interested in the possibilities of this agreement in Australia. Like, I criticized it before, but, you know, it was attempting to look at the news business model and kind of confronting that directly. Like, is there a way that we can work in partnership with these tech companies? But I think they've shown time and time again that they are too fickle. You invest in a newsroom, that's not a short-term thing. There's the expenses of spinning something like that up. You want that to be in place for a long time to really manifest those possibilities, and have, especially where you have a lot of experienced senior journalists and people who have, you know, 10, 20 years experience presenting current affairs shows, that kind of expertise and experience in the format and the medium gets passed down to the juniors, and that that's such a valuable kind of cycle for actually bringing people together and building up those skills. And when it all fractures and fragments like that, that stuff is gone. So that's why I think that, these types of things are never really cared about or understood, financially. And to tech executives, that's a good outcome, right? Because everyone, news should be a free market. Facts and meaning should be a free market. We should be able to produce it and consume it in ways that kind of map to our utilitarian preferences. And so, we don't want this kind of centralized body of people who are experienced in doing the thing to be the ones delivering the thing to a mass audience. That's so if we kind of accept that that era is over, and like, I don't think that it is over. I think that people still gravitate back towards the mainstream media for a lot of reasons, but I think there is a sort of stability to that level of information access that people still want. So even though the audience isn't a kind of not necessarily there and present in a more traditional way, there might be some possibilities for kind of restoring that. I don't think it's out of the question, but I think we do have to start looking at the kind of end game, like what's happening here, because the scale of layoffs, that is just, it's astonishing. It's really hard to even kind of find words to describe the last sort of 6 to 9 months, just like how fast and sweeping and I guess because we're still in the middle of it, like obviously, David, a lot of people have been personally affected, so maybe you have a better handle on like the impact and what's changing, but I think we're kind of still in the middle of it. We don't really know what's going to happen.
Oh, I don't either. No, I still feel like we're absolutely smack bang in the middle of it, so I think it's really hard to sort of make informed calls on that stuff.
I think one, and just speaking to something that you raised there, Mark, around people wanting to return to kind of mainstream information stability, and there still being a need for that in some respects. One of the things that gives me some optimism is that, this is going to sound bizarre, I just want to forefront that.
Okay. We'll decide if it's bizarre or not.
The audience will decide. Vote in the comments. But the fact that organizations are being taken apart, that they are being forced to close down, shutter, and lay people off, means that they were doing their job to an extent that powerful people didn't want them to be. Because as far as a communications platform goes, it's not good for the people in power to have to rebuild the entire thing, and especially not with AI. It would have been better if they could have kept all these people with incredible experience and incredible talent at communicating things and got them to promote their ideologies and promote their politics and become the communications arm of their political or corporate movement. And, mainstream media gets a lot of flack, and some outlets more so than others and some more fairly than others. Obviously, there are big corporates like Fox who are already doing that. But in New Zealand in particular, I have a lot of issues with the way things are reported. And you'll hear me on this podcast frequently mouthing off about them. But the powers that be have more issues a lot of the time. And you saw that very much during the campaign, the election campaign last year, where Winston Peters was saying he was going to come for people's jobs. People starting to refuse to turn up to interviews. At the moment, you have Melissa Lee, the Minister of Broadcasting, refusing to be interviewed about either News Hub or TVNZ. These people are fucking scared of these organizations, because there is a level of reportage that is still happening because the institutions still have a core set of beliefs that kind of goes beyond just that manufacturing consent. We only do what the real estate companies want because they're our advertisers, kind of conception of things. And so, and I've said this plenty of times before, there are a lot of good people who are still in those systems who are trying to do good stuff. And that means that there is an inflection point there where this can still be salvaged. My hope was always that these institutions could be reformed to move away from access journalism and advertising-driven funding kind of models. And clearly because those were failing and have failed now for increasing numbers of outlets. But the worst place that could have gone is if they'd just picked up all those oil contracts and all those cigarette contracts and just become mouthpieces for those really destructive corporate interests. And that hasn't happened either. So I don't know. I've gone, they just got more rambling than it got bizarre, I think.
Yeah, I was trying to work out where the bizarre bit was going to come
in. No, it just ended up being, I thought it just ended up being correct, right?
Wasn't bizarre at all.
No, okay. It's kind of bleak, really, the whole thing. But I think this always going to be exciting and interesting opportunities. Like, I hope that if there are some young people out there listening to this who are like want to go to journalism school and become a journalist, like, it doesn't sound like the greatest time, but actually, like, it's a really exciting and interesting time because people have, like, we don't know what's going to happen, and there is this unprecedented opportunity to actually to change things, and that's interesting. I mean, maybe I'm just trying to salvage some optimism out of everything that's happening, but I really, for me, I guess my major concern is the tech industry's taking over the information sort of filtering space. Like I can rant about manufacturing consent and all that stuff, but I think a more primary concern to me is the professionals dealing with information and delivering that to the public, shifting from people being experienced and trained in journalism to basically tech company executives and product managers and software engineers. And like we've seen examples of that with the Twitter censorship sort of debates and the debacles around that, where there were people like with zero experience in communications or journalism making huge decisions about what content should go out and what shouldn't. And the other thing is, you know, the tech industry actually worked a lot with the journalism industry and politicians, partly intersecting with that Trump period of time to develop regulatory codes of conduct and to do that whole thing. And like another sort of facet of the kind of burning down, we need a word to describe the sort of the mass layoffs in 2023, sort of post pandemic interest rates bubble kind of impact, or whatever we describe it as. Like one of the other effects of that has been Elon Musk buying Twitter is also quite important there, tearing up all of these codes of conduct and ethical guidelines, firing the ethics teams, firing the people from the news world who are working embedded in the tech companies. They've all lost their jobs now. So that communication between the industries has broken down, and the people, the conversations aren't happening anymore. And I think that's, to me, that's the kind of urgent and alarming space, because there's such a gap between people's perception of what's happening with AI and the kind of the reality of the business model that the tech companies are pushing. And I think that's quite important for journalists to get their heads around this, that the AI is not going to replace journalism. It can't. And at the start, we kind of went through some of the reasons why that is happening. And it doesn't sort of make a difference if it's just about putting out spam and fluff. But the issue isn't so much like what is being put out, it's the way that it's being created. And so what's really going on is that there's a shift in the economics of computing at large scale to sort of towards a kind of planetary scale computing grid. And the economics of that are sort of driving this need for these companies with this kind of high growth business model to shift processing into their own data centers, to take processing out of people's personal computers and into their clouds. These massive investments in data centers, building them beside hydroelectric dams, these like very, very high high power consumption, high water consumption systems that have these huge impacts. You know, they need business for that. They need constant use. Idling all of these servers in low power states, and the massive explosion in GPUs, which has also changed the basis of kind of computing hardware, has kind of created like a supply rather than a demand thing. And so that the AI is a sort of answer to like the demand. It's kind of a forced demand. It's not coming from what the audience wants or what the creators and writers and journalists want. It's coming from the fact that tech companies have this very cheap way of rolling out these big data centers, and they want to maximize that because that, and the way to maximize that is to convince everybody that they should, instead of using their computers to compute, they should outsource that and they should pay rent to the data center. I don't know if that sounds ridiculous or sort of outrageous, but
not
to
at
me,
all.
That's like actually the real economics of it.
It sounds horrible.
Yeah, it does. It does. No, I'm completely with you. And I think it does feel like, yeah, you know, I'm a simpleton when it comes to this stuff, but it does feel like every day I go on the internet and I'm being told this is what AI is going to, why I need and what it's going to be used for. And the amount of AI video that I'm being fed at the moment and being told this is the future, you know, we're all just being told this is it, this is it, this is it. I don't think anyone wants it. We're just being told that's what we want.
Yeah. I mean, filmmakers certainly don't want it. They don't want sort of like alien tentacle hands, chest busters coming out of people's shoulders or stomachs or whatever. We're just like random numbers of fingers.
How do you push back on, like, maybe this is a tangent, but I think it's an important question to ask regarding the way in which this is sold to people as a product or as a tool. And that is to say that actual creators, whether they be artists or game developers or journalists, are gatekeeping. And that this is just a tool and it just helps people who haven't put the time in to develop the skills from producing the content that they want to be producing.
Well, I mean, gatekeeping has value, right? It's not wholly a negative thing. I mean, I know we
get
it
canceled, Mark.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't believe I'm defending gatekeeping now. but like, we there are some things that we do want to outsource. Like, I'm sure both of you do not care about the internals of like how a computer system works, or you know, the weird design decisions that are involved in getting like a digital interface out to the public. So you want to outsource that rubbish to me, right? Like, like you do not want that stuff in your brain. Like, trust me. And like, again, like I couldn't do what David does, going, you know, taking cameras into really interesting and weird public and private spaces and getting people into these situations. Like, I'm really, really bad with conflict, and I would really struggle in those situations. So I want to outsource that to people who have a vision and are really good at that and can produce that and transmit it back. Like, I don't want to be good at everything. And I think that to me is like where gatekeeping comes in, around taste. Like, there's an old discussion in art, you know, and about tastes and how important like learning taste is. And I think gatekeeping serves that function. So like, you know, there are negative aspects to it, but I think maybe we've gone too far on the negative side of it, because there's like actually a positive function of like people who've practiced something and have done it a lot and have, you know, made a lot of a certain type of thing are generally better at it, and they can, you know, you can learn from that. And if you want to do that, you know, you can develop your own taste. And I think the issue with AI and the way it's sold is around that. It's basically saying, you know, don't climb the mountain. You know, don't train and prepare yourself for this big journey up the mountain. Get a helicopter, fly right to the top. But then the problem is, you know, you just get pushed out of the helicopter onto the mountainside and kind of fall back down. Like, it's, I mean, maybe that's like a bit of a ridiculous sort of way of summing it up, but I really do think that there isn't a magic button that you can press to just suddenly have 10 years experience or whatever. You can't just magically do anything. You have to put in the work, and you have to make the social connections in a particular industry or whatever, or, you know, like help people out and receive the sort of reciprocity and like the utu, you know, around that's like that. You can't outsource that stuff. You can outsource the grunt work, you can outsource specialization to others, but you can't outsource like what you want to do. And I think I don't know where this is going with the whole kind of news thing, but that to me is my answer to that question around that you were saying, Kyle. I don't know, am I a bit off base there?
No, I think that's good.
Something you said earlier as well, just about thinking of those young journalism students coming through, and I keep been thinking about them ever since you mentioned it. But I think there is, it is so, yeah, I'm pretty negative on all of this, but I think there is a, it's so important for people to still be enthused about getting to the truth and telling stories, because there will be ways to reinvent this and to make things vital and good again. I just don't quite know what that is. But I think people do want, people are still, you know, people are seeking community and truth. And I think those, there's a way that I think, you know, AI is certainly not going to solve a lot of those holes in people's lives. And I like to think that real journalism can find a way to blossom somehow. But again, it's how it's how it's funded and where that comes from. That's the big issue.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of summarizing it. I think that yeah, community and truth are always going to be important to people, and so they will always be seeking that out.
And I saw, you know, I have, you know, I've got a lot of friends in music, and they, you know, they were sort of in panic about AI a lot recently. But, you know, I drove to see a band that I loved a couple of days ago, and, you know, they're so community orientated. They have a Discord. They have, you know, they give out their cell phone number so people can text them, and they're very present. And, you know, the show was packed out. There were like 600 kids there. The line to the merch table was like so busy the entire time, and people were just so engaged for that real sense of community and being connected. And AI at that moment in that room felt like very far away. And this is a weird tangent to go down, because I'm just talking about some band I like, but I just found that very encouraging, and it was all real and present and honest, and people were looking at each other in the eye and getting to the truth of it themselves, and that felt really encouraging.
I think that's a good little anecdote to leave it on. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
No, thanks for having me. This is the most fascinating stuff that we're in the middle of here, and I don't know how it's going to end. I hope well for all of us. we'll find out, right?
We will. Thanks for joining me, Mark, as well.
Yeah, it's a fascinating conversation. And I'm glad that we reached a nice sort of optimistic kind of note to end it on, because I think it's important, you know, to, yes, everything's bleak, but, you know, I'm still excited about the possibilities, and I'm not going to give up.
Yeah, fantastic. Fucking A.
If you've enjoyed that, share it around. Let people know we're out here doing independent media with no funding model whatsoever. We've got a Patreon in the summary as well, if you do want to throw us a couple of bucks. But just sharing it on your social media sites, letting people know that we're out there is good enough for me. We'll be back on the weekend with our regular current events. But that's been another episode of 1 of 200. We'll catch you next time.
If artifices are denied, live in a pointless life, but learning all your lessons from your politics, there's no distinction. Now it's paid with good intentions, and I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize a cost we ought to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day in this vindictive, forgetful fucking rain. It feels like we're all